So just to give you an idea of how we're
going to... This is Sandra, and I'm Eileen, by the way. Okay.
How we're going to go through this. We're going to talk in general about eating disorders, how they develop, what causes an eating disorder, the continuum of eating disorders. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the treatment protocols, and then we actually have another section where we'll talk about the specifics to the Orthodox Jewish community and answer as many questions. We're both really comfortable with being informal about it, being interrupted to some degree. We want to get the information out and answering whatever questions you have. We appreciate your interest in being here. And learning more about this, particularly both of us have we've been in the field for almost 30 years, and we've long been working with the Orthodox Jewish community, and we're really pleased that we can talk about it a little bit more openly and really help some of the young people and older people that we know are suffering more constructively now. So, should I start?
You can start.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with how I would describe an eating disorder in my office, in my practice, in a very user-friendly way. I say the degree to which one's thoughts, feelings, behaviors around food, weight, body image, and exercise, the degree to which it interferes with, without giving it like, you know, it has to be this, it has to be that, the degree to which it interferes with the quality of one's life, one's ability to be social, one's ability to participate, ultimately one's health, and potentially one's life. The degree to which one's thoughts, feelings, behaviors around food, weight, body image, and exercise interfere. Some of my patients would say, I often say, you know, how much space is it taking up inside your head? And how does it interfere with the quality of your life? That said, what causes an eating disorder is a combination of physical, emotional, and behavioral streams coming together, congruent circles coming together, with genetically based biological medical determinants that interfere with the thinking process and how one feels about oneself. So whether that comes from, you know, a genetic predisposition to be a size and weight larger than what the social culture will allow, whether that comes from the genetic predisposition to be more obsessive, more anxious, more compulsive, more perfectionistic, whether one's thoughts and feelings about their food, weight, and body image come from some metabolic dysfunction that they might be having. In this culture, it is really not acceptable to be a size or weight other than what we see, you know, what's idealized in the community. So those pressures create, you know, I call it eating disorder with all of those realities, the biological, the physical, the emotional, coming together. The eating disorder actually, and this may sound strange to some of you, becomes a creative adaptation for survival. It's a way of feeling better about who you are and your body. It's a way that says, if I do this, then I will feel better about myself. Now, unfortunately, many of us can go through that process. It's like a developmental process. Some people can go on diets and lose weight and be done with it. Other people, under the pressure of going on a diet or needing to get thinner, there's a genetic predisposition, a biological reality that gets triggered, and they get stuck in that process. And that triggers the spiral into an eating disorder. So I want to get very clear about it. It's not a choice. It's like, you know, some people become alcoholics. If you never drink, you never become an alcoholic, but you have that predisposition. And so some people, when they start on diets, become caught in that spiral. And then the hardest part about it is that we actually live in a culture that reveres this. So I used to tell this story about a snowstorm many years ago. Maybe not that many, I don't know. So where there was like 3 feet of snow outside, and they had on this 4-lane highway, they had only plowed 2 lanes. And I was looking out the window with 4 of my girlfriends, and they had only plowed 2 lanes, and cars were going in both directions in this on 1 lane. So they were going back and forth, 4 feet of snow around. And all of a sudden, this person comes running by in the middle of the snow with cars going in both directions. So my first girlfriend goes, "Oh my God, look at that person. They're so committed." And the next person goes, "Oh, look at that person. They're so determined." And the next person goes, "Oh, look at that person. They're so disciplined." And I go, "Oh my God, look at that person. They're so eating disordered. They're willing to put their life at risk because on a 4-foot snow day when they had only plowed 1 lane for cars to go in both directions, they had to go out there because their mind would not allow them to not do that." So eating disorders are about what happens to the mind when it's undernourished and restricted, and the sort of spiral downward that occurs mentally, physically, potentially fatally. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. Any questions so far? Yes, go ahead.
What you are describing, which is very interesting, it's really kind of what we would call also obsessive compulsive disorder, where some people have this kind of predisposition, and once they start dieting, it will say...
That's correct. One of the variables that enhance it, we don't know, this is a field that's maybe 30 or 40 years in the making, so... One of the variables that enhances, exacerbates, and perhaps even causes an eating disorder is obsessive compulsive disorder. That's why I said there's a genetic predisposition. Not everybody is genetically predisposed to be obsessive or rigid or perfectionistic. And those variables, including anxiety and depression, increase the probability, increase what we would call the risk variables of developing an eating disorder as a way of management. It's so that's why I say it's a creative adaptation.
Coping strategy.
Yeah.
However, once someone is involved with an eating disorder and entrenched in an eating disorder, they become more obsessive compulsive. So sometimes it's a chicken or egg. It's hard to know what comes first. Does the obsessive compulsive component really lead to the eating disorder or vice versa?
Right. And you'd want to check if that was something that was there before the eating disorder started. So before we would, one of the treatment strategies for an eating disorder is medication. And before you would treat the obsessive compulsiveness with a medication, you want to make sure that that's not something that happened because they have a starving brain. Okay. So let's go back to the, I'm going to kind of map out what the different eating disorders in light of this obsessive compulsiveness, and then we'll ask some more questions. So let's think of eating disorders as a continuum, either because of biological realities or emotional realities or environmental trauma or stress that make one feel bad about oneself. So eating disorders are a continuum of I don't like myself, I don't feel good about myself, I need to fix myself. And if we look at the far end, I'm going to just say this is anorexia. And anorexia is about, I don't feel good about myself, I'm not worthy. Now, keep in mind that this is what the mind is doing. Okay, it's all happening in the mind first. If I was an artist and I was painting a picture, my picture would reflect what's going on in my mind. If I'm a musician composing a piece, my piece reflects what's going on in my mind. So too with life and eating disorders, what I do on my day-to-day is a reflection of what my mind is going through. So anorexia is about not being worthy, not feeling good enough, not being willing to take things in. I don't deserve it. I'm not good enough. I shouldn't have it. I don't enjoy taking things in. Now, I don't take in pleasure. I don't take in people. I don't take in acknowledgement. You notice I didn't say anything about food. That's the mind. That's what the mind is doing. It's actually saying no to life. So if I roll that over into food and relationships, it's saying no. Bite plate for anorexia is no, okay? And it tends to happen in that very rigid, perfectionistic personality. So let's just leave that there for a second. If I move a little bit further down the continuum to bulimia, bulimia tends to happen in a more impulsive mind. So anorexia happens in a more rigid, compulsive, perfectionistic mind, and we see those symptoms as a result of that mind. Bulimia tends to happen in a more impulsive personality. So the bulimic message inside the head is, on the impulse, I take things in, and then I feel guilty and shameful about that and have to get rid of it. So I haven't said anything about food yet. So on the impulse, I take in relationships, I may take in sexuality, I may experiment with drugs. I may do more impulsive things and then feel guilty and shameful about it. That's part of a bulimic mindset. So what that looks like in my food and my exercise is that I take things in on the impulse, I eat more than I would like to, and then I have to get rid of it. So that may be restricting, over-exercising, using laxatives. The way that I manage my over-impulsive personality and actions is to do what we call compensate. And we compensate by either restricting or doing something that feels like we're getting rid of it. So bulimia on the bite plate is about yes, but. And it's not just about food, it's about life. They are very impulsive in their relationships. They may go to school and quit. It's very hard to sustain. There's a lot of chaos in bulimia, and it's about that more impulsive personality. Let's leave that there. Then we move a little bit further down the continuum to binge eating disorder, what used to be called compulsive overeating. And compulsive overeating is about the mind of not getting enough. So just think about that mind. So what that means is I need to fill up. I need to fill up this big empty hole inside of me. And I never get enough. I don't get enough love. I don't get enough attention. I don't get enough respect. I don't get enough understanding. That's the feeling. That's what's going on inside the head. And what that looks like with food is I don't get enough. What it looks like in relationships is that there's this constant pulling. So binge eating disorder is about saying yes to everything. And that's what it looks like in the food. I can't stop eating. If you listen to people talk about it, that's what it looks like. So the bite plate for binge eating disorder is yes. And the bite plate, so let's go back. So now we have no for anorexia, all on that same continuum of I don't feel good about myself, I don't like who I am. Based on personality traits and genetic predisposition, the response is going to be different. I don't like myself in anorexia, it's going to be about no, I can't take it in, I don't deserve it. In bulimia, it's going to be like I'll take it in on the impulse, but then I'll feel guilty and shameful about it, I don't deserve it, I have to get rid of it. Okay. Often when patients call my office who are struggling with bulimia, they'll go like this. I have to come in and see her. On the impulse, they're impulsively like, I'm going to do something about it. And if my secretary will say to them, I don't know, I'll see, we'll see if we can give her an appointment, and we call them back and say, okay, she's going to see you, what will happen?
Cancel.
They'll either cancel or they won't show up. So on the impulse, it was like really like I had to do this. And if you give them what they want, they feel guilty and shameful and non-deserving, and they don't show up for that. So that's just an overall mental place. So then we move further. So it's yes, but in bulimia, and then in binge eating, it's yes. And the healing process, what Eileen and I do in a parallel process between what goes on with food and what goes on with people and relationships, is begin to heal this by teaching anorexia, sufferers with anorexia, how to take things in, how to say yes instead of no. Part of this is about relationships and life and opportunity. And my part of this is about how to take in food. Yes, how to say yes, how to feel deserving. And that's a parallel process. Sometimes her work goes a little faster, and sometimes my work goes a little faster, and sometimes there's a pause in the middle. But it's a long process because it's really about repatterning that whole brain and thinking process, and we work together on that. So that's the healing process in anorexia, learning how to take things in and say yes and be okay with that. The healing process in bulimia is learning how to be a little less impulsive in your relationships and your life and to take things in and keep it. It's okay. You don't have to feel guilty about that good thing that happened to you. And the healing process in binge eating disorder is to learn how to say no, ironically. These are very caretaker people who are saying yes to everybody and the universe, doing things for lots of other people, but feeling this big empty void inside of them. And so the healing process for them is to start saying, no, I can't do that to you. I can't drive you to Brooklyn. And to deal with the feelings that come along with disappointment and confrontation and having your own voice and taking care of yourself, which is a reversal process. So Eileen is teaching how to do that in life and relationships and people and opportunities. And I'm actually working on the same parallel process in food. All right. Maybe you don't have to eat four bagels today. Maybe you could say no to that fourth bagel. You know, just learning how to create neuropathways that allow that feeling of no to exist instead of the feeling of no to feel like deprivation, confrontation. So that's the map. Very often we will see somebody who's struggling with anorexia start to take things in, and this is important, I think, to know, start to take in people and become a little bit more bulimic.
That's right. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah. So there's a slide on this, so that if they're actually getting better, they may actually become a little bit more bulimic because they're actually, and usually in that perfectionistic, rigid anorexia mind, the bulimia looks more like overexercise. So you'll find a lot of overexercising in anorexic patients who are actually starting to maybe take in more food, but feel like they need to compensate. So you might see that. You might
see
a little bit
more purging.
Right.
Right.
You might see a little bit more purging, like a parent would say to me, my daughter wasn't throwing up when she first came to see you, and now she's throwing up. And I'm like, oh, she's actually getting better. But, you know, that's an individual thing. I'm not going to go out and say that that's okay. But
yeah, we're not saying purging is healthy.
Yeah, we're not. But I'm saying that this is a fluid
right.
continuum. It's not unusual that my compulsive overeaters will come into me with a journal that says I had four carrots, I had three cucumbers. I'm like, oh, what'd you do? Go anorexic on me? You know. So it isn't unusual that the anorexic person, sufferer, forgive my language, it's hard to like get it all, the person suffering with anorexia feels in fact that she or he is a compulsive overeater, and that once they get started they won't stop. It's not about that I don't want to eat, although it may become about that after months and months of not eating. The underlying feeling is I can't trust myself. Once I start eating, I'll never stop. Or I don't want to be like that person or that person or that person. So I'm just not going to go there. So there's a lot of overlap and movement on this line. That's why we call it a continuum. So when I'm talking to a patient or a family about this, I could be talking about anorexia and they'll often go, and then I could be talking about bulimic parts of this and they'll go like this. And then they'll, so they actually have a feeling of all three parts. And so we would call that sort of like a trans-diagnostic, like there's a little bit of everything, even though some people may lean one way or the other, or there may be movement as things progress or as things get worse. There may be movement from one part to the other. It's the anorexic's greatest fear in getting better that she, in fact, will become that compulsive overeater. She has seen, or he has seen, people who have recovered who actually get bigger because they're healthier, and that's a fear. So that's the underlying piece, that's what presents, that's how we kind of put it in place for people who don't know a lot about it, and even for people who do know a lot about it, they go, oh, I never thought about it like that. Do you want to add anything?
I wanted to talk more about low self-esteem, because I think, you know, underlying all eating disorders, when people ask me what causes an eating disorder, it is really, eating disorders are about self-esteem. And everyone struggles with self-esteem challenges, particularly growing up. That's part of the developmental process. People with eating disorders struggle with a more seriously low self-esteem, a more painfully low self-esteem. And that's something to watch out for when you have family members, when you have children who are really not feeling good about themselves and so hard on themselves and so perfectionistic, which is we're also going to be talking about, which was like the next part, but we can talk about it all together. But that perfectionistic drive is part of what drives people towards eating disorders, because it really is an attempt to feel good about oneself.
Right. And that's the basis of the line of the continuum is, I don't feel good about myself, I don't like who I am, and these are the developmental ways in which I actually attempt to feel better.
That's right. That's what eating disorders are. It's an attempt to feel better about oneself and to feel some value, to feel some self-worth. It's interesting, some people with anorexia will be very, very afraid of becoming normal. There's a real fear of that because normal is just average, and average isn't good enough. Average is maybe like everybody else. They feel like they have to be better than average, that's something really to be aware of.
And they feel that sometimes because they don't want you to know that what's inside is that they feel really bad. So it's doing the 150% of anything and everything so that you don't look inside that window and see that I really feel the one word that comes up a lot is fraud, or like this void that's inside.
The other key with eating disorders, with bottom line of eating disorders and with treatment and with recovery, I believe, is relationship with self. It's one of the most important things. And people who have eating disorders have trouble with the relationship with self. And part of that is that fraudulent piece. People don't feel authentic. They don't feel that they've ever had the opportunity to really develop their true self. They've been too busy trying to be who they think they're supposed to be, not being who they're not supposed to be, trying to, you know, maybe just study, and not maybe there are people who love the arts, for example, but there was never really enough time to go into the arts because they felt then when they're going to fail as a student, they were going to fail their family. So they end up really not being true to themselves and not developing that healthy relationship with themselves and that healthy balance, right? We all have to balance different parts of ourselves. So that we can meet expectations, family expectations, community expectations, and self expectations. And that balance is very, very challenging, but that's what health is about. Another important piece with eating disorders is healthy human beings have to be able to tolerate and be comfortable with a wide range of emotion. We're made that way. We're made to have a wide range of emotion. We get angry, we get sad, we cry, we're happy, a wide range. People with eating disorders tend to not be so comfortable with that wide range of emotion. So that's something else very important in psychotherapy, to learn to be more comfortable, again, with all the different parts of themselves, while still trying to be the best person they can be, trying to maintain family values, religious values, and also being able to tolerate more of who they really are.
Yeah. So what tends to happen in that is that the transfer of those feelings transfers over, you know, if I'm angry about something, consciously or unconsciously, mm-hmm. It transfers over into the language of food, weight, and body. I could be angry at me about my thighs. You know, I can feel angry, but the anger wouldn't go towards the person who got me angry.
It all
the
gets
anger
charged
would go
into
towards
self.
Me. So there's a in other words, I can get angry, but instead of hearing that you're angry because somebody, you know, left you out of the party or then somebody would come in and say, I'm so angry that I ate that food, or I'm so angry that my stomach sticks out like that. So, I would say, you know, what happens with your food is what's happening in your life, so that they would come in, I'm really bored with that cottage cheese. Well, you know, to me, that's like, that becomes the language of what's going on in their life. So I'm not, you know, as a nutritionist, I know the food values, but I really know that I'm listening to the Play-Doh. I'm listening to them tell me what they're painting in their life. I'm listening with my third ear because it's telling me more about they've learned to talk in the language of food, weight, and body instead of talking in the language of I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel disappointed, I feel like you're rejected. Those are not common because those things create conflict, both outside and inside. So the language becomes, gee, I feel really angry about my cottage cheese.
Or it's okay to feel bad about yourself because you're fat, or feel bad about yourself because you haven't been able to stick to that diet, when actually there may be other feelings and emotions, other anger that gets all turned inward, and the body becomes the battleground. And unfortunately, in our society, a lot of, you know, we all grow up, girls in particular, but boys too, grow up with, your value lies in how you look. Your value lies in your weight. You should feel higher self-esteem if you eat less. Girls grow up watching their mothers on diets a lot, and boys too. And that's very, very problematic and unhealthy. It sets up that, again, that becomes an important aspect of self-esteem where really it shouldn't be. Yes, we should take care of ourselves. Yes, we should look as well as we can. But that's not where our self-esteem should be coming from.
And I, you know, just to tail on to this, I mean, let's keep in mind that women have historically been valued for what they look like, how pretty they are, what they look like. But really caveat, and men were historically valued for their scholarly tendencies and their economic income and the power that they had. Caveat, it's not like that anymore. Okay, so men and boys are very much seeing images and pressure to have their, so women were about, women, self, body, always there. But be on the, I mean, we keep adding, because when we first started talking about this, we didn't talk so much about men and boys. But now there is a real prevalence, that there was two articles that came out in the Times, there's a real prevalence of boys struggling with body image and sense of self attached to their body. It's a little different than we see with women who are looking to be thin. Our boys are looking to be muscular and buff and have a different body shape, the ones, you know, that than what is natural and what is normal. And therefore, when a 12-year-old or 13-year-old boy looks at a picture or an image of the bodies that they're seeing in the men on TV, wherever they see them, that image says, what's wrong with me? They look like this. I look like this. That's the way I'm supposed to look, which is what women have been looking at historically, which is why the incidence of eating disorders is, you know, more prevalent in women. But it is really, really quantuming in this culture at this time. So I would not, you know, ignore the fact that men are really attached. You know, like Eileen was talking about the finding of self. The eating disorders is about, this is who I am and this is who I'm portraying in the world. The men are also very much caught up in this at this point. Our boys and men are also caught up in this, so we need to be on the lookout for that.
Mm-hmm. So the good news is that people can get better, and that's important to keep in mind. I know there's a lot of fear, and I know in the firm community there's been fear also about talking about eating disorders, about coming out in the open about eating disorders, fear about marriage, fear about, you know, how the family is seen in the community. So I really appreciate that we're all here today and we're talking about this and we're working on this, because it's a huge problem in the community. It's, you know, and the whole issue of genetics, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the field. It's not really clear about, you know, nature versus nurture, what's genetic, what's learned, what, but the good news is people can get better. This is not a life sentence. It's not, you know, I don't believe it's an addiction where once an eating disorder, always an eating disorder. Yeah, right, okay, so.
There are addictive pieces right. of this, but not the classic addiction, right. Because people have, you know, you can abstain from alcohol, you can abstain from
right.
drugs.
You have to have a relationship with
you
food.
You have to learn how to have a healthy relationship.
That's right.
Whatever that means.
So it's really important to keep in mind that people can get better, and trying to find specialized treatment to work with eating disorders is really important, because eating disorders, they are unique because there's a certain language. Eating disorders sort of have a language and a thinking all of their own. Part of what's so hard, too, if you have a family member who's struggling with an eating disorder, I know for parents and for siblings, it's so frustrating because it's sort of counterintuitive. It's unnatural. What do you mean you won't eat? That doesn't make sense. You know, what do you mean you feel fat? You're skinny. What do you mean? You're beautiful. You're smart. What do you mean you feel terrible about yourself and you feel stupid and you feel ugly? And it's really frustrating. And it feels sometimes like, you know, they must see what we see. And they must be able to get better. Why are they doing this? Is it just attention-seeking behavior? Are they doing it, you know, to get back at us, to hurt us? And it really is an emotional, psychological problem. And finding someone to help, getting professional help is really important. Because we know that usually with eating disorders, you have to get professional help, or people often don't get better. It's very, very sad. People spend their lives being eating disordered, somewhere along that continuum that Sandra described, you know, more or less. Or people will come to my practice and say, you know, I've been fine for years. Yeah, I had an eating disorder back in college, but I've been fine since then. Or, you know, I had an eating disorder, you know, when I got married, I had a bout of an eating disorder, but then it went away. Well, it doesn't really just go away. You have to figure out what the bottom line is. Why is this person having this, again, unhealthy relationship with self? So treatment is really important, and not to be afraid of it. I mean, unfortunately, it can be timely, it's expensive, but people can get better, and that's really the bottom line.
So we're going to stick sort of to our little plan
yes.
of talking about the eating disorders, what they are, you know, just to help people understand what they are. Then we're going to talk a little bit more about treatment in this
yes.
section. And then we'll talk more about the Orthodox community, the uniqueness of the treatment in the Orthodox community on the second part two, part B.
Right.
So any questions about, you know, what we talked about in terms of what an eating disorder is, how it manifests, how it starts? Yeah.
I was just curious about the new category of eating disorder, the
orthorexia.
Right, of the obsessive healthy eaters.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not actually a new category. It's just a little different. Keeping in mind that I don't feel good about who I am is the underlying reason for anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder. Orthorexia has a slightly different underlying thinking process, which is more about I need to be healthy and pure, so it isn't so much about weight, and it's about restrictiveness. It may actually float on top. In other words, one of our anorexic patients may bring this in on top of her wanting to be thin, that I also want to be healthy, and I can't eat anything that has this chemical or that chemical or that chemical. So orthorexia is more about purity. It is sometimes very often connected to obsessive compulsive disorders, more attached to germs, health, well-being.
And not necessarily anorexia.
And not necessarily weight-related.
Right. We'll say people with orthorexia will talk about not being that concerned about their weight. They're just concerned about eating healthy, organic, pure, and isn't that healthier anyway? Isn't that good than what we're supposed to do? So
it,
absolutely. Right. It's challenging because it's really irrational.
Right. And all of these disorders are not, you know, look, it's generally accepted. I like to talk about this as an issue. It's generally accepted that if we eat a low-fat diet, we're going to be healthier. It's generally accepted that if we exercise, we're going to be healthier. So why does that make that a problem in anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder? Because the population, in their mind, takes what's generally accepted and flexible and tolerable to an extreme that becomes brutal, abusive, and sometimes cost them their lives. So,
and I wanted to add one thing also to something Sandra said before about these different categories. Very often, anorexia, like restricted eating, and then binging overeating, are, I call it, opposite sides of the same coin. So people who may not really be so bulimic, but at a certain point lose control because it's very, very hard to keep starving. So restriction, dieting, that's why diets don't work. That's why the diet industry is such a wealthy industry, because diets don't work. That as long as we keep restricting our food or we try to cut out food groups, that's not going to be the answer, because inevitably we're going to go off that diet or we're going to break through the starvation and then we're going to overeat and binge.
Right.
So that's why finding a healthy relationship with diet and exercise and food and body, and also, and you mentioned this too, accepting genetically, we all have genetic strengths and weaknesses in terms of the way we're taller, we're shorter, we have, you know, heavier bottom parts, we have heavier top parts, whatever it is, fighting against genetics is really an uphill battle. And you can't win. You can't win fighting against the way your body is basically meant to be. So trying to come to terms with that and come to peace, we have to come to peace with our bodies. Because as long as we're fighting with our bodies and fighting with our nature, it's going to be pretty unhappy and unhealthy. Yes?
If someone, for instance, eats on Shabbos,
yes,
regular, or maybe overeats on Shabbos.
Yes.
And then during the week they eat very little, only protein. What is that considered, bulimia or anorexia? Then they walk like 2 hours on Shabbos to get rid of what they ate on Shabbos. What is that considered?
The question is how does Shabbos, you know, how do you compensate for what you do on Shabbos? It happens to be a huge problem.
It's a huge issue. But how do you define, she's asking, how do you define that specific eating disorder? It's disordered eating. It doesn't really matter in a way to call it, well, it's more anorexia, it's a little bit, but it doesn't really matter. It's restricted, unhealthy eating.
With a compensation basis.
And disordered eating.
You know, usually I say along the continuum of eating, there's no, after I do that whole thing, I usually go, and then there's no clear-cut anorexia, there's no clear-cut bulimia, and there's no clear-cut compulsive overeating. It's a mix and match, and it has to do with where the person is in their recovery and also what's going on in their life. And so that behavior actually is a compensatory behavior.
Right.
But would it actually fit into the diagnostic criteria
or anorexia?
I don't think so. But does it create a lot? The problem is not where it fits. The problem is, and here's a key word to listen to, the degree of turmoil that it creates inside one's head, the amount of disdain and distaste and chaos and unhappiness and secretiveness, you know, like what does it do to the peace and calm of one's life?
Right.
You know, that's
and
really what it is.
We're not supposed to feel as though we don't have permission to eat. And that kind of situation is more like in order to deserve to be able to eat on Shabbos, you have to basically not eat all week.
Compensation.
And that compensation, and that's not healthy. That just like the walking is to compensate for the eating on Shabbos.
Right.
Yes.
Especially so far it's been the view of oneself and this disordered view. What happens with the relationship between the family, the view of others, the relationship, the contact with others, where does that come into that?
I'm not sure of the question.
The question is it all self, or is it the primary focus, or where does the
well, of course,
relationship with the rest of the family interact with
it? It's incredibly, you want to destructive and disconnecting. And so what happens is if I don't trust self, I really don't trust a lot of what's going on. Plus, I don't really think about it. It's almost like if you could think about an addict in this regard, like I have to hold on to this regardless of the cost that it costs to other people. So there's a lot of disconnection and there's a lot of turmoil in families. Plus, you're watching the people that you love
right.
do things to themselves that are destructive without it, you know, any logical right. input or effect, or no matter what you say. Like sometimes when I say something to a patient, I'm like, what did you hear me say? Because I know that I know what I'm saying, but I don't know what they're hearing. And pretty much through their need to hold on to this, they will not hear what you have to say. And it's very, very costly to the family relationships, to the siblings. It's a horrible disease that I think it's minimized because people will say, why don't you just eat? Why don't you just eat? But families go through an enormous amount of turmoil
yeah.
and disruption and destruction because
it's very painful in the whole, for the whole family. And often when a child has an eating disorder, it is symbolic that there's something going on in the family system that needs to be addressed. There's something going on in the family relationships that needs to be addressed and looked at. And good treatment usually includes some amount of family therapy, depending upon the age of the person who's suffering. If it's a younger child, certainly family should be involved. And I always, even my older patients, I like to bring family members in because I think, of course, family members have been impacted by it. Family also needs to learn how do you deal with the person with the eating disorder. Because like I said before, there's that whole language. Like you tell a person with an eating disorder, they look beautiful, they think they look fat. Oh, you look great today. Oh, I look terrible. That means I look fat. I gained weight overnight. So you have to learn, how an eating disorder works, how to interact with the
behavior that you're going to see, because you're going to see behavior all day long.
Right, right. Yes?
I have two questions, but they're connected.
Okay.
First of all, the overeating is also, we can say, this low self-esteem, or that would be a different...
Yes. It's all low self-esteem.
Well,
that's one
there's
thing
a continuum of low self-esteem, but one of the things that Eileen talked about is using food as a way of coping, anesthetizing, distancing, distracting. So what happens in compulsive overeating most of the time is that there's really an inability to communicate how you're feeling. There's a real desire not to create any conflict or contrast or turmoil. And so you're kind of swallowing all your feelings. Mm-hmm. And the way you keep those feelings down is by putting, you know, what makes you feel better is food. So it feels like I'm filling up. I'm getting the love I need. I'm getting the attention I need. I'm getting the understanding I need. Not really, but that food becomes the way to which I deal and cope with pain, distraction, anesthetizing, distancing. At least that feels better in the moment.
Right.
It doesn't feel so good afterwards.
And then there's terrible shame and self-hatred that can follow the overeating, and then that's a very, very painful cycle. What was the other part of the question? Yes.
I teach high school girls, and I've seen it for quite a number of
years. Wow. So you see a lot of this probably, unfortunately.
A very interesting, there's no medium. When I went to school, or the beginning of years of my teaching career, there were medium.
Yeah.
Most of the class was a size 8, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody ate lunch, everybody ate breakfast.
Yeah.
We weren't so busy with food. We were mm-hmm. busy getting our subjects, our marks. And I'm noticing that in the classroom now, and this is for many years I'm observing, there either is ultra skinny or even ultra fat. It's the medium is totally gone. The average person, you don't even find them in the classroom. There's no size in it. There's either 2, 0.
Well, can I tell you what I think that is? I mean, the theme is to be thin.
Right.
The theme is to be thin. So those people that can, in whatever way, hold on with their knuckles and be thin are thin. Those people who can't kind of let go of the windowsill and say, I can't
do
this.
I can't
do
this extreme. I'll do that.
What's the difference? What's the point? I'm never going to be like that, and I don't care. And the self-esteem that goes along with that is awful. Because,
right.
You know,
right.
And when those people actually get to be adults, because they have learned how to cope with all of those painful feelings of being left out, excluded, not part of the group, to adults, that has become such an entrenched behavior that the one thing that I hear all the time with my adult compulsive overeaters, I have a compulsive overeater group, is that it's too hard. I can't do it. And it becomes part of life in general. Everything is too hard, and food is the answer to everything. It's a behavioral pattern that develops because everything that they attempted to do, food became the answer as a default. And so over years and years and years of doing that, that's what we see in binge eating or compulsive overeating in adults because they haven't picked up any other skills.
Also sizes. You know, you talk about sizes before. The average size for American women used to be size 12. What was a 0? It's crazy. Think about it. A 0. Nothing. Should be a size 0. That's the goal. So that's part of the, again, societal problem.
The words that you said about being average, they want to be
that's right.
Average.
That's right.
Average isn't an accomplishment.
Right. With average, they feel like they're almost invisible. They're nothing. Right. And I think in terms of that, that's something to be aware of also in the community. You know, we want our children to do well. We want our children to reflect well on us. We want so much. We want good for our kids. And the better our kids do, the better it reflects us, the better we hope they're going to have a better life. They're going to be able to, you know, have a better husband, wife. But we have
better
to be careful. Better shit off. But we have to be careful. Right? I can say shit off here.
I know.
Right. But we have to be careful because that drive to be that perfect, to be better, special, to be, people are supposed to feel special, right? We're all born special. We're all born that we're good enough. We're all born that, you know, so being able to be that average is okay, that just being okay is okay. Yes?
I just want to, you know, bring out that, you know, I have daughters that are married, thankfully, God. You know, they have friends that are, you know, already in their mid to upper 20s and they're just not getting married because they have a weight issue. And it's become that, you know, in our society here that it just, you know, I mean, we're talking about boys that are heavy too, that they refuse to meet heavier girls, and it's just beyond my scope to understand how, you know, when they themselves or, you know, boys or whatever, I call the shot, and I'll give you an example, and I wanted to set up my daughter's, one of her best friends, and it's somebody in Queens, and she said something like, well, they should really, these parents should really kind of form this support group for kids who have weight issues, and then they should kind of, you know, come together and, like, you know, set each other up with these kids. And I was just so taken aback by that comment because it is, there's such a, you know,
it's very painful.
Prejudice.
Absolutely.
And it was so hurtful, you know, I mean, even because I'm a compulsive eater, so, you know, it was so hurtful to me, and I took that so badly. And it is, you know, people, these girls today are just dying to be thin. They exercise inadequately. And even if they're thin, they have such a bad body image.
Right, right.
And being thin, you know, is that perfection. And it's the Hollywood. It's the
yeah.
Press.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned before that our bodies are programmed to be a certain weight, mm-hmm. a certain shape, and that if when we try to change it, it really cannot be done. But I think that this whole society has programmed their bodies to be different. To go along with this lady and this lady, when I, 40 years ago, when I went to weddings, I have a very large, very Orthodox family. And the girls get married at 18 or 19, mm-hmm. and invariably. The average size would be 8 or 10 was considered wonderful. The girl
sure.
was slim, beautiful.
Right.
Today, in that crowd, mm-hmm. there is not a single young
right,
girl.
Right.
They, you know,
that's
if
right.
there is one who's overweight, The mothers take them for treatment, whatever. By the time it's time for a shidduch, they are a size 4, a size 6.
And that's why eating disorders sometimes go underground, because if it's weight, if there's an obvious problem with someone's overweight, then they want to treat that. But if the person's really thin, even if they are really ill, they're really sick, it's still, it looks okay. It looks good maybe to the outside world, and so it's not treated properly.
When I take a walk in spring on the Shabbos, yeah, I'm looking at the groups of young girls. I very, very seldom see a girl who's not extremely slim, and I'm saying, these girls come from this Eastern European,
right,
Ashkenazi.
Well, that's the body type that we're talking about.
But the whole generation seems,
right,
to have managed to.
So the question is,
except some who can't.
Right, and the question is, what do those girls and the rest of the girls in the culture who have this stocky genetic makeup have to do to have that happen? And those that can't manage that,
right,
emotionally, physically, behaviorally, are on the other end,
right,
of the continuum. Eileen was talking about valuing other things. How do we value other things if the ultimate thing in the culture is to get married and have children, and the criteria for getting married and having children is to be this? And I'm seeing a lot of this. And then on top of that, should you have a child who gets caught in this culture, and we're going to talk more about this in a second, who gets caught in this culture and is eating disordered as a result of it, what is the stigma on her or him having an eating disorder and being able to be matched? That's a real problem, because that's what I'm seeing.
Yes.
Can I ask you some questions?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Did you say that eating disorders are more common in men or women?
Oh. It used to be 90% women. The percentages might have changed a little
percentages
bit.
Percentages have changed. There's recently...
Right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Right? We see how many men are in the room and how many women are in the room.
Well, no. I don't believe that that's a indicator, because the mothers are the caretakers. It doesn't necessarily mean that they may not have men children. I don't know that everybody is here for themselves. I think most of us are here, I would prejudicially say, to find out more about how we could help our children. But the statistic used to be 1 in 10 people with eating disorders was male. And last week I was forwarded two or three articles that said 1 in 4 now.
Wow.
So that's not
about in the Orthodox community. I don't think it affects men so much.
So listen, we don't know what goes on that much in the Orthodox community, because it took us a long time to get to the place where Orthodox women were willing to come in and get treatment.
Much less Orthodox,
you know,
men.
So
right?
I couldn't say that I know that there are X amount of Orthodox men. I don't know. I don't even know if they know. I don't even know if their parents know, because who's
right.
going to talk about it?
It's true. It's true. The other question to you. Yeah. Yeah. It's disordered eating. I think it's disordered eating. And like we said, it depends on when, like Sandra said, compensatory behavior. If you're starving all week to eat on the weekend, that's not healthy. That's not what Shabbos is meant to be. We're supposed to rest on Shabbos. We're supposed to eat, you know, we eat well on Shabbos. There are certain foods that we eat. But we're not supposed to starve all week to be able to eat on Shabbos. Yeah, no, that's not healthy.
So
that's
wait a
disordered
minute.
Eating.
Okay. So oranges, I'll be the nutritionist. I'm putting my nutritionist hat on.
Okay.
That. So let's say you had a child that was eating oranges and coffee all week. Would that be? Huh?
And sardines.
All right, are you happy with that? I'm not so happy. No. So again, it's the degree to which it influences your self-care. Let's look at two different things here. As a nutritionist, have a bias that we can take good care of our bodies by feeding it well, emotionally, spiritually, la la la. So from the nutritional part, how do I best take care of my body? Do I feed myself to be well, to be healthy, to be fit, to be strong, to be present? Or do I feed myself to be thin? Now, which one are you guys doing?
Right. Plus, we should be eating well every day. It's not a matter of, oh, we should only eat well 2 days a week. We should eat well every day.
So when thin takes over all those other things, we have a problem. The degree to which it takes over, we have a bigger problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, and then behind you. First you, and then behind you.
All right, wait.
Go ahead.
First two.
I actually, it's not so much a question. I have a response to what this woman said. Uh-huh. I'm actually, I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. And I think, first of all, I don't think that the firm community and young women have changed their genetics. I think it's eating disorders. And I personally know and have spoken to multiple young ladies who, for Shidduchim, for varied reasons, have developed eating disorders. Some will not seek treatment at all, period. Others end up there because they, you know, have had heart attacks, have crashed
passed
their car,
out on the street.
passed out behind the wheel. You know, I don't think that, you know, all these thin girls that you're seeing, is it's not, you know, that they've changed their natural
shape. Yeah. Nobody can change that.
You know, and I
that's what I said. What's the how are they accomplishing that? At what cost to themselves?
I think they're accomplishing it by eating disorders that, you know, that they're then keeping extremely secret, so that, you know, not only for their shidduchim, but for their siblings, and, you know,
it's for the entire family, right? The extended family.
I know people who, you know, they're already married and they still can't share what they've been through with anyone because, you know, they have younger siblings. And it's just, it's unfortunate. It's beyond unfortunate. It's killing people. So
we applaud that you're here and you're talking about it. So that's really, thank you. Thank you for being here.
What I think you also said to the young man is that we have no way of knowing how many eating disorders are in the front community.
That's right.
Because, you know, nobody will talk about it, and nobody will, you know, I have spoken to people to try to, you know, help them and guide them towards treatment, and they absolutely will not go because they will not.
Right.
You know.
It's much, much more widespread in the community than anybody knows.
Well, I love the two of you as a team beginning. Because exactly what you said is so. The women are thin, what I would call emaciatedly thin, way beyond what their genetic predisposition allows. And so therefore we know, by your witness, that they're all looking like that. Most of them are looking like that. And by the one in the back who said that the ones that aren't looking like that are looking obese. We have a lot of this in the community. And it's really that people only come to us when they've passed out, they've been hospitalized, when they're actually forced to, and then we'll talk more about this in the treatment part of this. The shame of it is that the recovery process is long, and the parents and the culture wants them out of treatment much more quickly than we can get them better. So the unfortunate part of that is that why people don't get better is they don't stay in treatment long enough because it's a shonda or because
and
they won't get matched. But even without that, so we're going to talk more about that. But thank you. There were others.
There was a question behind. Did you have?
Okay, yeah, I'll try. Get really anxious.
Okay. Do you want me to come back to you?
No.
Okay.
I'm here also as a recovering.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Teaching, and I'm here to give my 2 cents, if I say so. You know, I like to see also advocacy, and that's something I'm passionate about.
That's great.
Also, because anorexia, people think that just like if you are so emaciated and you see every bone, then you're going to die. And I feel like a lot of people are not aware. Like, I know people have told me, so you're thin, but you're not.
You don't look really. Yeah,
and
you're right.
The truth of the matter is, you know, that you can lose your life before you
absolutely
reach X amount. And you can look thin and be really, really sick. So when I try to make people aware, they're like, oh, well, she's not, whatever, it's normal.
Right, you're right.
People don't understand. Really,
people
don't understand.
Absolutely.
The medical complications that get created by nutritional imbalance at any weight. At any weight.
Right. And someone can't, right, people often say, like, I'm not a skeleton. I don't come from the Holocaust, so I must not really have anorexia nervosa. And that's not true.
Right, it could come at different.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much. Yes.
I'm sorry. If a child has a problem of, like, a picky eater, uh-huh. Can you put that under umbrella?
Sandra.
No. It's a totally different topic. I mean, it's a topic of new emergence. It's a matter.
Is that picky eating?
Picky eating.
Eaters.
Selective eating.
Selective eating.
I just
eating.
Did a TV show.
He's not a little kid.
No, but he has been since he was
he's been doing it. My guess would be that he's been doing it since he was a little kid.
2 years old. He was
there are lots of reasons why people don't eat. It's kind of interesting. I did an interview yesterday about this. And, you know, it's interesting. We all have different hair colors, size. Why isn't it that we could all have different tastes? So that's my starting point. I can't believe that we haven't talked about this from the beginning. Some kids have what we call a sensory integrative disorder, and they taste things differently. I was just with my grandson yesterday. Something came into the room and it smelled, and he went like, whoa! He doesn't eat, you know, he only broccoli. Certain foods have a very pungent taste, a very strong taste to him. The rest of the four kids ate fine. So there's there could be a biological nature to a selective eating disorder. There could be a traumatic nature. I have patients who, you know, were forced to eat mushrooms or peas or whatever and won't go near them. We don't know that much about it. But what we're finding out is that there's a whole group of people that have a different sensory taste. I did an Anderson Cooper show recently. And we had these little taste strips that everybody put on their tongue. So if I passed them around, everybody put them on their tongue. To some people, it was like awful. And to some people, it was like nothing, paper. So the reality of it is that as individual as we are in all other aspects, there are some people on the continuum who we all taste in this normal bell curve range. Most of us fit into that. And there are some people who are hypersensitive, and there are some people who are numb. So that these picky children are in this hypersensitive category, most of them. Some of them have had traumas, but a lot of them that I'm seeing now are in this hypersensitive to taste, to texture, to smell, sometimes to light, sometimes what we would call neophobic. And you'd have, you know, and again, within that range, there's disordered and there's extreme. So some people are phobic to change. Now, how this overlaps with eating disorders is that most of our eating disorder patients are very what we call neophobic, afraid of change. They don't like new things. And so that person, usually most young kids don't like new things, so they like eating the same thing. As they get older and a little bit more risky and a little bit more, they try new things. Some kids, again, in that lower end, get stuck there. This, when I did the Anderson Cooper show, he only eats five foods. Now, is this a problem? That's what the interviewer asked me yesterday. It's only a problem if it interferes with the quality of your life, if you can't be social, if you can't go to school, if you can't go out with friends, and then it becomes a problem if the five foods that you eat are not nutritious enough to sustain your life and well-being. So it's up here.
It's complicated.
How do you get somebody to agree has this eating disorder to go?
No, we should take a break. We're supposed to take a break now.
Are we supposed to take a break now? No.
We
have 30 more minutes. Yeah. Okay, so we have 30 more minutes to speak. Yes, because there are other people who are speaking.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so we have 30 more minutes.
I was on the wrong
You're asking how do you get someone to get to treatment?
I thought we had another part.
We're doing it together.
We don't have another part.
We've been combining
I've been completely
them.
Wrong. I don't know what I'm talking
about. We're combining them. So
now we're going to move on to the treatment part.
All right. You know what? We'll hold that question. I want to try to get an idea of what the questions are so we can make sure that we can address them in the half an hour we have left. Yes.
In the dating.
Yeah?
In the dating process, when a gentleman dates, and being that we have a lot of very thin girls, some are unhealthy and some are healthy. How does one differentiate as a red flag, some red flags? I'm not.
That's a hard question, but we'll try.
That would be more like one of the signs and symptoms of an eating disorder.
All the people who didn't get to ask questions, go ahead. Yes.
I wonder if you would address bariatric surgery, uh-huh. Lefins.
Yes.
What's your take on that?
We will. Good.
How does it work?
Yes, in the back. Yes.
Okay, so I'm a nutritionist.
Uh-huh.
You know, 8 and 9 and 10 year old girls and boys, or 10, 11, 12, you know. And they say, you know, the child wants to come, they feel they're, you know, it's bothering them, so it's interfering with them socially. And I always have this fear, you know, when I see them, that I don't want to instill in the fact that they have a problem. child very overweight. Some of them are tremendous overeaters. Because I have these 8-year-old girls who eat like adults. They eat two chicken and they're looking for more food. And some of them will refer them to say, I think it's a disorder. And I don't know. But I don't, like, sometimes it's just teaching a kid how to eat properly. Is there an age that's appropriate, like, to start, like, are there some kids that are just too, like, they're not mature enough? Should they not be seeing a nutritionist? Should I just, like, sort of just see the, sometimes maybe I'll just see the parent and
look at them
properly? Like, I don't know. You know, I don't want to instill an idea in a child that they have.
Okay, so we'll try to get to anything else before, and then we'll start talking more. Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering about, I've been an overeater all my life, so I relate to all the things you're saying. I've also, over the years, used the overeaters program. So some of them, that they're specific for the anorexic
right.
women.
Uh-huh.
And I've sat in and I found that I identified also.
Right. Opposite sides
even
of the same
though
point.
I'm not that.
Right.
I'm a
right.
regular over.
Right. Right.
Whatever
right.
that is.
And there are differences and there are similarities, right? All eating disorders, male, female, right. different
what,
ages, there are certain similarities.
Yeah,
yes.
What's on my mind is the overeater program, the spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
How do you relate to that to
we'll put that in.
Your
we'll put that in the treatment
because
piece.
Because it's part of the recovery.
We will add that in the treatment piece, yes.
Okay.
In terms of, like, nutrition, the nutrition should be done before you start to see what the nutrients might exist in a person that could create certain nutrients can create mental deficiencies, too. So is there an essay done on that before you start?
Usually not.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you can be relatively presumptive, and it's very, don't forget, you're trying to, it's not, whether your calcium level is 25 and hers is 50, and I'm just using that as a crazy, just, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're deficient and she's not. It's,
no, that's not what you're saying. Uh-huh. Like, everyone has an essay, and in my mind, of a baseline where they are.
Could be. Some people believe more or less that that's...
It's a little bit too intricate
right.
for the process because just because it's not there right now, if you, I would be proving... you would, I, if I did an assay on one of my anorexic patients and their blood chemistry came out fine, which usually does because the blood chemistry is homeostatic, meaning unless we're looking for organic disease, the blood chemistry is going to be pretty good. The blood is going to draw calcium from the bones...
She's talking about if you have too much of this or not enough of that.
It's
one perspective.
Yes.
It's a perspective.
It's usually
in
not
treatment.
Part of the standard treatment.
Yes, I don't mean to rush people, but we're trying to do it as much as we can in the time we have.
School principal, and I actually came with the parents' recommendation. 6th, 7th, and 8th grade is for pre and then adolescence. Mm. And then you see a trend in the classroom where everybody's bringing carrot sticks. And all of a sudden, you're beginning to see 2 or 3 girls really shrinking in size,
mm-hmm.
looking a little pale, not paying much attention to mm-hmm. teachers in class. So I'm just wondering, would you handle this as a, you know, introducing nutrition to the class, proper nutrition, whatever, besides the fact that I've contacted the parents and, you know, we're working on that. I was just wondering what you say.
I think the schools to educate about eating disorders is so important.
And wellness.
And wellness.
And eating disorders.
And
like,
eating
disorders,
right.
And whole self. Whole
that's
self,
right.
a value of whole
right.
self that's more than
yeah,
value of body.
And that
right.
dieting, and that dieting should not be a rite of passage. Our daughters grow up believing that to be female means at a certain point you have to start dieting and eating carrot sticks. That's what girls do.
And,
that's what good girls do.
And also to educate parents that there's a neurological chemical change that takes place when one goes on a diet. You would be very... this might not be the right community, but when you wouldn't put your daughter on any kind of acne drug or any kind of hormone or anything without seriously investigating it because it's going to affect her growth and her well-being. Well, dieting actually does that. It changes hormones. It changes reproductive capacity. So premature dieting is like as dangerous as putting your daughter on some type of drug to fix some other process. And you may need to do that for asthma or diabetes, but when you do that with diligence and you do that with respect for the power that that's going to have. When you put somebody on a diet at 10, 11, and 12, and those girls that are putting themselves on diet as part of the cultural club are changing their neurological chemistry and their biochemistry, and it is dangerous. It is dangerous, one, because it's just deficient. And number two, it's dangerous because those people who are have a proclivity and a risk factor for developing an eating disorder are going to develop an eating disorder.
Yeah. Yes?
Can you address eating disorders in an older population?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think we're going to pause because I thought we could take a break and have another hour and a half, but we don't. So we're going to now talk about what?
Treatment. more.
Wind me up.
We're going to try to focus more on treatment. And there are many different, there are different levels of treatment and different kinds of treatment. We'll talk about the bariatric surgery and those, and the Orthodox community. So we're going to do a little bit on treatment and Orthodox community. 11:15, is that what we're aiming for? 11:30. Oh, we just got a little more time. Okay. Usually one begins, if you're trying to find treatment for an eating disorder, you begin with a nutritionist and a therapist. Sometimes you start with a therapist or you start with a nutritionist, but somebody who specializes in eating disorders. It's very important to find someone who has had a fair amount or a lot of eating disorder experience. And now the good news is there are many of us. There are many people out there who have had a lot of experience with eating disorders. And that's very, very important because somebody asked the question about, you don't want to create an eating disorder where there's not one, for example, or you don't want, to say the wrong thing to somebody who maybe is vulnerable to an eating disorder or has the beginning of an eating disorder. You wouldn't want, to make it worse. So it's very important to get help from somebody who really knows eating disorders and is aware. And any good therapist, clinician, nutritionist should then be able to make a recommendation about what's going on, does this person require treatment or not, and if so, what kind of treatment. And we often need a team. We need a medical doctor involved, we need a nutritionist involved, we need a therapist involved. Sometimes we need a psychiatrist involved, because sometimes medication, we might do an assessment for the possibility of the need for medication. So we try to create a team. If somebody is if we decide or we see that someone does have an eating disorder, in fact, you create a team, and a good team works together and works well together.
So, question.
Yeah.
You have in service, like people with conditions and arms and provide service, because usually it's people that thinking they are okay. They're eating normal, they're good looking, just thinking they are positive everywhere. But if you have in service, like someone is coming in the house and speak, because usually they don't
want to
go anywhere in
the
medical.
And maybe some of the people who do home visits or come to the house to do treatment.
Right.
I don't know what's available in terms of that. I know more about going outside for treatment. But right, and I think that as for family members, you have to really, it's a choiceless choice. It's not optional. And parents will say, I can't get them to go. And I'll say, what do you mean you can't get them to go?
They don't want to go.
I understand they don't want to go, but just like you'd make them go here, there, or somewhere else.
They're thinking they're okay, they're eating normally.
I understand.
They don't want to look like big.
And then maybe it and maybe it would help then for a parent to go talk to the therapist or the specialist, describe what's going on with their child or family member, and then maybe that the professional can help them to figure out, okay, how do I get the person who's suffering into treatment? Yes.
I work in the addiction field, and, with adolescents that come in, when they're forced to come by either parents or their school, when they're forced to come, the success rate of them, becoming abstinent is very low. So I'm just wondering, is that the same with eating disorders, or do you just not have a choice?
I believe you don't have a choice. I believe that you have to get the person help. And even though there's great resistance to getting help because the person is desperately holding on to their eating disorder, for whatever reason, they need it. And
that's part of the work. I have somebody really from the community that I came in. She was definitely forced to come, and she looked at the tiles, and it took me a long time to get through the tiles, and but she's doing great now. So
that's right.
you know like
So you can't give someone a choice whether or not they want to come, because if they also agree to go get help, they feel like they're failing their eating disorder. If they're trying to desperately hold on to their eating disorder and be the best eating disorder person they can be, and you're trying to interfere with that, that feels very, very threatening. So there's going to naturally be resistance. Most people don't say, oh, great, I want to go get help.
Right, and that's why you need to be, it needs to be somebody who, you know, like somebody else was looking at the tiles, another nutritionist looking at the tiles would say, oh, I don't think she really wants to be here, I can't help her. But, you know, you really need to be with people who know what the eating disorder is saying and work mm-hmm. through that. That's really, you know, even with therapy, that's the same thing.
Yes.
I was looking at school. How do you get a parent to realize that a daughter has an eating disorder when her pediatrician is saying it's a stomach problem and the blood work is coming?
That's right. And the blood work often comes out good. You can't go by that. That's one of the problems that Sandra was saying. We can't go by, well, my blood work's fine, so therefore I'm fine, because that's not necessarily the case. I think the school has to really be proactive in terms of education and doing everything that you can to make sure that family gets help.
One of the questions that I like to ask is, you know, how much, if this was a circle, how much, and this is your brain, like how much space is your food, weight, and body image taking up? And where is your friends, your relationship, your what you'd like to do with your life? Like, how much space do we have? And I usually like to do that in the beginning. And in the end, I like to do it again so that the eating and food might take up, like, 15%. And, you know, I just graduated from this university, and you know, I'm getting married, I'm going to Israel, I'm da 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 da. That's a really important thing, is really where are things going to go if all you think about from morning, noon, and night? And by the way, how does that feel? Does that feel peaceful? Does that feel tumultuous? Does that feel rewarding? Or does that bring you a lot of pain? So that you kind of have to unwrap it a little bit. You know, nobody's really going to, you know, most of the people say, I'm good, I'm fine. Oh, I love I'm fine.
Did you have one more quick comment? Because I want to get to the other hands.
Yeah, no, I just, you know, nobody wants to go into treatment. And, you know, nobody really wants to give up their eating disorder. But I think, you know, especially for the loved ones and, you know, the schools and people, it's important to realize that this is 100% deadly. And that,
that's right.
You know, it can kill you any time. It can, you know, it only takes, you know, one purge, it only takes, you
right.
know, one extra day of not eating.
Not eating,
and,
right,
and
right.
That's right. It's very, it's safe. Very, very serious. Absolutely, yes, in the back.
I wanted to reiterate what you said about forcing somebody into treatment. A lot of these girls, they really want treatment, but they can't ask for it.
Right.
They're ashamed to ask for it. And if they ask for it, they feel like they feel, like you said, they feel the eating. So they need to be forced into treatment, even though they fight you. They really want that. They want somebody else to take over.
That's right.
They're just so exhausted.
It's absolutely true.
Right. And not only that, it's a huge, because of the structure of the finance and the insurance companies, and this is area, it's a huge financial burden to get treatment. We're talking about a pharmacologist, a therapist, a nutritionist, possibly some other form of treatment as well. Most of this is marginally covered by the insurance companies. So there's a huge financial burden on the family. And many of my patients do not want to put that burden on their family. Again, if we get back to, I'm not good enough, I don't deserve it, with that mind, I shouldn't be doing this to my family. I should be taking that money.
That's
you
right.
know, my brother's supposed to go to Israel
right.
this year.
And it's hard for families to understand sometimes. Why do you need so many sessions? Why do you need twice a week sessions, for example? Well, that's like an hour and a half a week. Think about, you know, how much time there is, and think how much therapy has to cover in order to really help someone recover. So it does require a lot of treatment. One last thing, and then.
One more thing.
Yeah.
As a recovered eating disorder person.
Thank you.
Right. Because I found potassium levels, whatever it is, knowing that I'm going to go to the doctor,
mm-hmm.
and then an hour later,
right,
passing out.
I'm passing out.
That's
that
right.
Has nothing to do.
That's right.
Right. And that's why I was kind of vague about answering your question about the brain chemistry, because it's so hard to prove and detect, and it doesn't mean that much.
Right. Right. Thank you. In terms of bariatric surgery and lap band, I don't know if you want to speak to that too. I mean, you know, I think generally with eating disorders, there's no quick fix. There's no easy fix. And even bariatric surgery is not a quick, easy fix, right? It's a serious surgery. It's
bearing in mind that the basis for this is underlyingly psychological or behavioral. So I either don't feel good enough about myself, or I've given up, or things are too hard, and so I'm eating my way through, or it's become a behavior for how I function. The physiological piece of it I can fix, but if I still have that underlying desire that when I feel sad and I feel lonely and I feel bored that I need to eat, I've got an even bigger problem now. Because now I have this tiny stomach or this surgical piece that I'm going to rupture or burst or expand, and it's going to fail, not because the surgery was fine. The surgery could be perfect. But my behavioral component hasn't been addressed. Right. And my emotional component hasn't been addressed.
So it's important
to... So for some people, there's success in the fact that behavioral work means that, you know, every time they eat something that they shouldn't, they get sick. So that changes the behavior. So it is successful for some people. Some people are successful. But many people still have this underlying emotion, and they will, instead of eating the cake, they'll liquefy the cake, or they'll get, you know, Carvel or something that they can drink, because they can drink it and still get it past the band or the surgery. So if you don't, there's
you
a way to get
address,
around
really
it
saying,
if you haven't got to
the emotional. Address the emotional component is really what we're saying. Yes, in the back. And then yes, I promise next. Yes,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Are you saying treatment, you see a therapist first?
Yes.
And then could you address, on average, how long is the treatment and what is the cost? Talking in
okay, I will, and I'll get back to, all right, one last comment and then in the blue, yeah.
Okay, I think that today the majority of doctors who are doing the treatment,
they insist on that. Yes.
You must have a nutritionist for life. They hook you up before right. and after, and you
yes.
have to.
But getting in touch with the emotional component, they may say go a few times to a therapist, to clear you. And you know what? Those therapists are working with those doctors and are going to clear you possibly, maybe not necessarily, but so you have to, the person has to take the onus is on them to really make sure that they're fully, or as fully as possible, addressing the emotional psychological components. Yes. Sorry, you've been very patient. Go ahead. Thank you.
Say, you don't, even when you know you need treatment, right. even when you think, yeah, I have to go, and even when, honest to God, like, you know, you're walking up a hill and you can't make it up the hill and it's scaring the heck out of you, you still don't want to do anything about it.
Right.
Ed is your friend. Like, that's...
Ed stands for eating disorder.
Ed was my best friend. And giving up your best friend is really hard.
Very hard.
Treatment is important in that. You know, people didn't understand if I'm going to be forced to eat, why can't I let my family do it? Because in treatment, it doesn't feel like your choice anymore.
That's another, that brings me actually into Maudsley. Let's just talk for a moment about Maudsley. What did you want
I
to
want to just go say ahead. Before we go to Maudsley, into the idea that when you develop at a young age or at a medium age, a time when you're supposed to be developing skills, coping self and self, when you develop a symbiotic relationship with the eating disorder and it becomes what you do and who you are and how you think and how you negotiate the world, the idea of getting rid of that compass without knowing what's on the other side of it, without knowing who you are, you've now developed 5 or 6 years of self through eating disorder. The idea of giving that up is like saying, okay, could you cut off this part of my body and I'll go on with the other part of my body. It's so frightening. And as much as you want to, as much as you know that this is holding you down and holding you back, it is like saying, how do I give up that part of me that helped me get this far? And what will I use to get the rest of the way? So it's a huge... Right. You know, I want to and I don't want to, and I want to and I want to.
And as long as someone needs the eating disorder, they're going to keep the eating disorder. So one of the important challenges in psychotherapy and in treatment is why does the person who's suffering need that eating disorder? What purposes is it serving? And you've got to be
and
able to address
that in some more
that's
helpful
right,
way.
That question successfully in order for recovery to happen. I tell patients this all the time. No one, I can't make them better. No one can force a person with an eating disorder to recover. There has to be that they're ready to, because they don't need the eating disorder as much anymore, and ultimately not at all anymore.
Or developing tools that will help you.
Now I can walk across the street.
Right. Now I can run across the street. And it's sort of
it's
like
a process,
developing
absolutely.
Tools for strength in self. That is not connected to the eating disorder. So it's a process that takes place to develop confidence, awareness, self, and ability without the eating disorder.
I just wanted to say something about the holidays that are coming. Purim's coming, Pesach is coming, and that presents specific unique
every
challenges. Shabbos is every week, right? But this is even more, right? They're food holidays, they're special food holidays, and it's something just to be aware of, because it's challenging. It really is. It takes something that's already problematic and makes it even more challenging. So I thought it was interesting that Eating Disorders Awareness Week and the Jewish holidays, it's all sort of coming together, and it's a good time for us to be doing this, I think. Yes?
Do you mind if you tell us what is the death rate for this anorexia, bulimia, and binging?
Death rate?
Death rate?
The death rate. What is the death rate?
I can say a little bit about it. Anorexia has the highest mortality rate, but certainly eating disorders not otherwise specified or referred to as ENDNOS also has a high mortality rate, because if you have somebody who is restricting, over-exercising, purging, that it can take such a great toll on the body. As far as bulimia goes, it doesn't have as high of a mortality rate, but it's certainly people who die of bulimia. For people in the age range of like 14 to 21, it's actually 12 times higher for girls to die of an eating disorder than other causes of death. So it has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. So it's very serious and very important that people get treatment.
It's also very confusing to get a number for you. So let me just tell you, if in the past somebody dies of a cardiac arrest because of an eating disorder, they die of a cardiac arrest.
That's
if
right.
they die of a suicide because of an eating disorder, they die of a suicide. So we don't have. So this is a buildup of a life that creates these other consequences, and the other consequences are what's written on the death certificate.
I just wanted to let you know, too, the National Eating Disorders Association does have some information on mortality rates if you want to know more. But I would also just point out that, like she was saying, it's hard to get a statistic. But I know there is the statistic out there that over one person's lifetime, 50,000 people will die.
Right, but my point is also how minimized even the numbers that we have are because of all those other ways that people die from an eating disorder as a consequence of the eating disorder.
So I know you didn't mention about binging. I know of someone who does this binging pain for a while, and every time I speak to them, it's like they're saying, "Oh, there is no such thing as anybody dies from binging." And
it really kind of speaks to what they were just saying, which is that for a lot of people who struggle with binge eating disorder and maybe other have other complicating health factors that are related to that behavior, it's difficult to say somebody died from an eating disorder, specifically binge eating disorder, if, for example, they die of a heart attack or something that's related. So again, I think it's difficult to come up with a statistic, because it's not necessarily what gets reported as the cause of death that we can say this is the number of people who die because of this. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Just one quick comment on mortality. Unfortunately, I think some people die while getting better. Like, they can die at a higher weight, less purging, because
Absolutely.
The body's gone through so much. Like, mm-hmm. nobody knows who is to die. Sometimes
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's true.
The body is so unique that there are people, unfortunately, there are people who have been recovered who end up dying in their sleep or having a heart attack or
different vulnerability.
The body is not meant to be challenged in this way, and we don't know. Some people can handle more than other people.
Right. I want to also address in older populations, but what?
How do you like help someone
again, psychotherapy, psychotherapy, nutrition therapy, those are the things you don't want to wait for there to be a full-blown problem, Right? The longer an eating disorder goes untreated, the harder it is to treat. Again, so, never impossible to treat, but you want to get somebody to get some professional help sooner rather than later.
And sometimes, you know, when people come in to see me, you know, a mom might bring a daughter in, I'm like, maybe she just needs some information.
That's right.
So information and guidance or That's maybe right. support in making food changes is something that could be done. The degree that, you know, I make some suggestions to you and you can follow through with them, that's not about an underlying issue.
That's right.
The degree that I make suggestions to you and you can't follow through with them, coming to me for information that you want to improve your well-being and you can't follow through with them, what's there? What is preventing you from that whole spectrum of aliveness, wellness, presence, that way of eating, from just being thin? And so that becomes, okay, well, do you need more help from me? Do you need a therapist to help us figure out what's stopping you from doing what you came here to do? You know, like we all go on a diet, and then what's that's how I got into this field in the first place. I mean, I came out of school thinking I was going to help people eat a certain way. That was 30 years ago. And then I got in the room, and like I go, okay, this is what you have to do. And then they do it for a week and come back and go, I'm like, so when that psychological part is, what is getting in the way of you doing what's good for you? That's where we began to team up. You know, it's like, oh, and that's why I became more psychologically based, because it was important to help people to be able to make those changes.
So in terms of older populations, all right, in a minute, go ahead, yes.
Yeah.
That's okay.
In terms of treatment, specifically of a teenage girl, is there any sense or any modality where a therapist would call the parents and say, sit down, breakfast, lunch, supper, force your child?
Which is Maudsley. You're getting us into something called Maudsley treatment. Maudsley came from London.
It sounds though it's going to be so counterproductive.
Well, sometimes if it depends on the age of the child, depends on what's happening in the family system, but some families want to take on feeding their child. And the one of the thoughts about Maudsley is if your child had, you know, God forbid, any other illness, you would want to make sure that, you know, you would treat that child. And when the child has anorexia, the child needs to eat, and the parents take on that responsibility to feed the child. Those parents need to work with a therapist, though, who a family-based therapy, FBT, who can focus on Maudsley or be a Maudsley coach for the family system, because it's not so easy to just get your child to eat. It's enormously challenging. So to make sure that it's productive and constructive, because it can often make the problem worse. So you want to make sure that you're having, again, a professional who's skilled in Maudsley, who knows family-based treatment, and can help.
If it's a somewhat or borderline rebellious girl, mm-hmm. it seems to me this will just...
Sometimes it's not the right. That's right.
It depends on the family.
It depends on many
who
factors.
Can be there with her. It depends upon how the family, the parents, couple works together as a team. They must.
There are many factors.
It depends. You know, so we would set it up either partially or wholly.
And again, a professional should help to be able to figure out: is this a family that can be successful with Maudsley? Is it going to be again constructive and productive, or is it going to make things even worse? And that's what a professional should be able to help figure that out.
And it's very difficult in the Orthodox community in particular. I've done Maudsley treatment both outside of the Orthodox community and the Orthodox. It's very difficult when one child is getting so much more attention than the other children. It's very difficult in terms of both the father and the mother's time to, you know, spend with this child. You know, you're devoting yourself to being coverage instead of a treatment team with that child. So it does create, you know, obviously every family has that, but particularly when there are a lot of children close at age, a lot of children with different demands and needs, it's very hard to just focus on that one child.
I've heard of therapists that recommend parents, teenage girl, their parents go down to lunchtime at school and make sure. I mean, it sounds absurd. I'm a psychologist.
Well, again, that's Maudsley, though. That's within that particular style of treatment. I just want to say something about eating disorders in older populations. And that's something else that's coming out of the closet, more so to speak. We're knowing that some people develop eating disorders at a later age, and often people spend their lives being eating disorder, don't get help, and then maybe start talking about it when they're in middle age. But it used to be everybody would think eating disorders were just teenage girls, and that's so not the case. We know that it crosses, you know, gender lines, it crosses ages, it crosses ethnicities, culture, and certainly age. So it's it's and as much as there are differences, because depending upon how old someone is and what community someone's living in, there are also similarities. There are certain basic things that are in eating disorders consistently.
Right, and if you again get back to that continuum of I don't feel good about myself, that can happen at any age. And so at any age, whether there's a problem in the marriage or a problem with the child, the parents can feel bad about themselves. And in this culture, the way to feel better about yourself is to eat better or fix your body.
That's
and
right.
So if you are somebody, even at 45 or 55 or 65, who embarks on a diet and
That's
you
right.
are genetically predisposed to be at a larger size or to eat more, you're going to trigger that
right.
reality.
Right. And with the challenges of aging, certainly that can be more and more of
the challenges.
Susan.
Can you speak to the special issues in the drug community where women are
Yeah, I think it's a huge challenge. And I think one of the things that happens is you're supposed to be skinny and just have a belly. And somehow that's part of, you know, being pregnant but not fat, which is, you know, not in fact how our bodies work and how pregnancy usually occurs. So those same eating disorder issues can happen during pregnancy and with the challenges of pregnancy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because some of the patients can actually work with the patients to feed the baby and have the stomach and be okay and sort of leave the eating disorder behind when they're pregnant and then come back to it. And of course, some of them cannot. It's really all about the individual's mind and how that person can manage with their thinking process the idea of having this stomach. And I've gone through pregnancies where people have completely
right.
dropped aside their eating disorder to be able to feed that baby on levels. And I've gone through pregnancies where there's been an inability to do that and damage
problems.
To the baby.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But in the from community, it's particularly challenging, again, because women are supposed to, you know, be able to, you know, have lots of babies and also look terrific doing it. And, you know, looks thin and terrific and to have all that self-control and self, you know, that perfection. And, you know, and really that doesn't fit together so easily or so naturally. So
there's
yes.
also pressure on the mother of the bride
yeah.
and how she looks. In fact, I told you about the weddings that I go to. I see these women in their 40s, they can have 10, 12 children.
Mm-hmm.
They look amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe not a size 2, but a size 6.
And unfortunately, their children are learning. They're watching their mother be eating disordered.
And
or not full-blown maybe, but again, along that continuum, have disordered eating, that diet mentality.
Right.
And that's, you know, we are the strongest role models for our children. So
right. what is the price? The price of being thin? Is it about wellness and fitness? And we look to the orthorexia. Is it about being well and healthy and
right.
fit and alive and strong and vital and present? Or is it about being thin? So really, from a global perspective for the community, I mean, it's really a consciousness raising about, you know, what is it that we're really valuing?
Yeah, and I understand when it comes to a shit up, a friend told me that people ask about the mother of the bride.
Yeah,
even
of course.
Grandmothers.
Of course, yes.
So if, in terms of treatment and having a team, how does a patient or a client, an individual, come into contact with that team? Or, you know, or is it through a hospital? Is it
sometimes the National Eating Disorders Association is a wonderful resource. You should all know about NEDA.org, right?
Yes, NationalEatingDisorders.org, and there's pamphlets with our organizational brochure and all of our programs.
It's not in the book. I'm not sure if it is,
no,
but there are pamphlets. It is? Okay, good. And there's lots and lots of resources there. There's a helpline you can always call. They can make recommendations and give referrals.
It's a list of professionals who specialize in eating
right,
disorders.
In the community.
And if you go for an evaluation with one or two or three professionals you can choose, they are doing this work, so they would have a team. So
right.
let's say if you came to me, I might refer to
right.
the team, Eileen and the
right.
physician. So I have a network of
right.
people that I work with and would refer based on the need.
And someone asked about cost, I think, about, cost of treatment. Treatment is expensive. Insurance companies often don't want to pay to cover eating disorders, although it's better now than it was, and Nita's involved with attorneys who work specifically to fight with insurance companies to get insurance companies to pay for anorexia and other eating disorders. But it's a challenge. But although there are therapists and treatment centers maybe that have some flexibility, some sliding scale, and again, Nita's a good resource to try to help put you in touch with those kind of organizations.
And another resource that you can call is Relief, Mrs. Levinson at Relief, where Rabbi Abadi is, and they can help, and of course, MASK.
Okay, good.
Yeah, Relief has Devorah Levinson. She's runs the eating disorder department, and I've consulted with her several times. She has a pretty good network of people in the Orthodox community.
Sometimes people like to go out of the community a little bit. They don't want to be right in the community and see somebody a little bit outside the community. I know when I was working in Park Slope, I got a lot of patients who came because it was far enough away that they felt like it was sort of safe. So.
And we work with them not to make sure that nobody's in the waiting room.
That's
when
right.
They come out.
We really respect that. We know how hard it is to attain treatment, so we want to support that. Yes?
I was wondering how much effort is put into educating our, something like this, of course, is wonderful, but starting with children in school.
Well, hopefully with this, hopefully,
right. I mean, we're working at it all the time. I used to work with the Jewish Board of Education and do consultations with the teachers, and from time to time we did things with the kids.
I don't hear that it's really part of the curriculum.
Well, we hope that will improve. We hope that will improve, and we hope that will make a difference.
So more effort has to be put
absolutely
into teaching children at a young age.
Right. People have to be willing to talk about this. And again, I think it's so wonderful that people who were able to come today and talk about having recovered and come out in the open about that. And hopefully everyone who's in this room today now understands more about eating disorders, is more comfortable to talk and to educate.
And to
or
take
to
it
go
to the school.
Take it to the school.
Teachers and the guidance
it to the
teachers and the social
principals,
workers in the
that's
schools.
Right. Take it to your shul. Talk to your rabbi.
Can we get
talk
this program?
To, that's right. That's right.
I just want to say, peace on insurance maybe can help people.
Yes.
If you have like Oxford, I know Oxford Freedom does it, and you can go out of network.
Yes.
You can get a rider, meaning when you sign up for your contract, you ask them to put in a biological rider, which means if you have anorexia as your diagnosis, you get unlimited.
Because it's considered a biologically based. So there are ways to get around it. Sometimes also when people are choosing insurance, it's better to take a more expensive plan if you think there's that's right. If you know you're struggling with somebody, with a family member who has an eating disorder, or you suspect, it may be worth that insurance to have the better plan. You want to try to get the best coverage that you can.
And the people that you are going to call know about this and can
yes,
really help you,
can help
direct you in the right direction. If they're dealing with eating disorders, they've dealt with that before.
Yes, in the back. Yes. Thank you. Well, thankfully you're doing well now and are here, so it's a big challenge. Yes.
The dating red flags.
You know, it's hard because I hate that this
everybody asks for diet coke and diet.
But that's not necessarily a red flag.
That's what she's saying.
Yes.
Exactly. That's what you say. You can't tell by that anymore.
Super thin. So do you have to family history
research? I hate answering that in a way because I don't want to support this idea that when it comes to dating that there has to be, you want to be able to, how do you identify the eating disorder patients so that you can stay away from that? We want the opposite. We don't want that to be a reason for someone not to date or not to be loved or not to be able to move on with their lives. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. That's very important. So I would never, we're not going to give red flags. Yes.
Changing perspective of what's being discussed, which is, I think I keep on hearing that there are problems in the firm community that cause an eating disorder, when I think the problem is more specifically, the problem is not with the way firm women are supposed to be, but the way firm women try to integrate themselves in a
culture, the American culture.
Yes,
right. Absolutely.
That causes us to be.
We're not saying that from community causes eating disorders. We don't mean to be saying that. That's not what we mean. It's absolutely
and
the larger American culture.
We have many babies and be happy with our.
Absolutely.
Babies. No. It's trying to
absolutely
adapt this external reality, the external self versus the internal self.
Absolutely. Yes.
This is a reaction to that. I remember when I was in seminary, there was a girl who, she wasn't in my apartment, but she spent a lot of time there. And I remember before Pesach, she was going back a little bit early for her brother's bar mitzvah, and this girl was in tears because her parents kept on telling her, you know, if you gain a single ounce in seminary, you're not going to get any shidduch of it, and nobody's going to date you, and you're never going to get married. Her little brother who's a bar mitzvah boy, God was going, I don't want you to come home if you're fat. They're like, and this is how, and like, I spent so much time with this girl, and she tortured herself over every bite she put in her mouth. The whole entire year, she was stressing out over it. God forbid she should gain half of an ounce in seminary, because everyone's going to know it's the second day that she walks up the plane that she's fat. And it's like, and it drove me crazy, because like, I saw this girl. She wasn't fat. She was probably size 4 to 6, maybe. Like, she wasn't fat at all. She didn't gain weight in seminary, as far as I could tell. And she looked great, and I felt so bad for her because there was such a pressure on her head that God forbid that you should not, and that you should gain 2 ounces because you will never get married.
Right.
So the culture, to some degree, has accepted the external culture. I've had patients who have had to leave treatment. I actually had a patient who left treatment very prematurely, and I found out a couple of years later that she passed away from the eating disorder. And I have a couple of clients right now who are really being taken out of treatment in a premature way because they can't be matched unless if they're on medication or if they're in treatment. So there is, you know, we're not blaming the community. I mean, the community is not the fault, but there is a pressure in the community to be a certain way, to be accepted, to move on in the culture as it exists right now.
Yes, Liz. Yes, absolutely.
I think out trends that they've seen, but it's important for all of us to recognize
yes.
that there's no one reason.
Absolutely. There's not one cause and one reason. Absolutely, yes.
Along with teaching children at a young age about the importance of nutrition,
mm-hmm.
What would you suggest would be a comment that you can tell a child how you feel about a young teenager or pre-adolescent coming home from school in a seventh grade, you know, setting and starting to comment on the diets like you mentioned, or even mentioning, you know, but there's one girl in my class, something really must be wrong, because to come home with that awareness that this is the trend in the class is now starting to become more nutrition-oriented with the lunches, bringing lunches from home as opposed to eating the school lunches, but even having recognized one step further that there's one child that stands out in the class, how would you suggest I, as a mother, were to deal with that comment? What do you suggest I say? How can I? I just want to help. You know, I wouldn't want to say anything to put any ideas into my daughter's head. But then again.
Well, I think you need to come from, you personally have to come from a perspective of balance and flexibility. That there's no, you know, that.
And no judgment and lack of judgment.
Lack of judgment.
Right?
And that,
more
you know,
accepting.
We all want to eat to be well and healthy
right.
and strong. And yet we eat for traditional reasons and we eat for pleasure. Like there's a full spectrum of reasons that we eat. We don't just eat to be thin. So that, you know, it's scary and it's sad when somebody's pleasure about eating gets restricted. So you want to increase, you know, pleasure, flexibility, balance, experimenting. And by the way, you are the role model.
Yes.
So whatever you're doing, she's got to see it.
That's right. Anyway, thank you all. We have to stop. So thank you.